next case before us is 20-4083, perhaps Geddes versus Weber County. Would counsel for appellant proceed?
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. I think the real difference or real dispute that appellees and our side is having is they believe that the complaint doesn't state a cognizable claim because we cite to the 14th Amendment rather than the Fourth Amendment. And I think that that position and the position of the district court really runs afoul of the principle that the district court and this court are well-established principle that the courts are to look to the substance of a complaint rather than the labels that a party may put on their claims. In this case, it's not even a label on the claim, which is clearly a Section 1983 claim for use of excessive force, but the substance of the complaint in this case over and over again claims that the individual jailers used excessive force that was objectively unreasonable in the circumstances presented. That states a claim, the substance of the claim, upon which relief can be granted.
Excessive force is not, it's not a freestanding claim. I mean, it has to be attached to an amendment, right? And you sure. Didn't do that. You attach it to the wrong amendment, which was the 14th Amendment.
Right. And that's, I think that's a, it does have to be attached to a, an amendment. But in this case, I think when you do look at the substance of the complaint, and it's absolutely clear what we're claiming is that there was a use of excessive force, that it was objectively unreasonable. That's the standard that applies, well, now applies both under this court's reading in McCowan, applies both under the Fourth Amendment and the 14th Amendment.
Why would it be helpful to you to suggest that yes, it's an objective lens that we're looking at, and that would have been more confusing, would it not? If the objective lens applied to both the 14th Amendment and the Fourth, then wouldn't it the court have been confused as to what amendment you were invoking? And doesn't that matter?
In this case, with what we actually state in the complaint, I don't think so. Because we're saying that it is the objective lens, which now under this court's reading of Kingsley applies to both the 14th and 14th Amendment for an excessive force claim, that it doesn't matter because it was clearly we put the defendants on notice what the claim was, that we were claiming that the use of force was objectively unreasonable.
All right. Putting aside whether you preserved your Kingsley argument for a second, even post-Kingsley, the Fourth Amendment and 14th Amendment excessive force claims, they are not coterminous, are they? I mean, under the 14th Amendment, you have to show that you have to inquire into the extent of the plaintiff's injury, which you don't have to do under Graham's test, right? I mean, Graham is totality of the circumstances. I get that. But under the elements of the test that are articulated, they're different, right?
I don't think they are different. I think this court in McCowan read them as coextensive, is that they aren't different.
McCowan said they both have an objective standard. They do have an objective standard, but is there a language in a McCowan that says they're coextensive? I mean, on their face, they aren't coextensive.
I think, the language in McCowan is that in that case, that the whether you apply the 14th Amendment or whether you apply the Fourth Amendment, also, as this course did in the more recent decision of Rowell, it doesn't matter that they are coextensive. There is an inquiry into, and these are when the Supreme Court in Graham and the Supreme Court in Kingsley, I think all that the Supreme Court in Kingsley did was take the Graham factors, the objective reasonable test, and apply them to the situation that the officers find themselves in when they're in pretrial detention. I disagree too that I realized under a state of Booker that there was a demarcation between when somebody's a pretrial detainee and when somebody is a an arrestee, that the, in this case, given the timing of the getting the judicial stamp of approval on the affidavit of probable cause, that they would be considered, that Mr. Geddes would have been considered an arrestee rather than a pretrial detainee. But I think that flies in the face of the facts of actually what happened here. Is the trooper relinquished custody of the county. The county had custody. This was long after he was arrested. And for all intents and purposes, for the facts of the case, the circumstances really call for application of the factors enunciated in Kingsley.
But the test was a judicial finding of probable cause, right? Isn't that what Booker calls for?
Well, yes and no. I mean, they repeatedly talk in Booker about a hearing, a probable cause hearing. But I don't disagree with you that it was a judicial determination of probable cause.
Okay, well, this is what really I'm struggling with in terms of the posture of this case as it comes here. I think there's case law that accepts the premise that you would not be bound necessarily by your complaint, that even at the course of summary judgment, you could alter, by virtue of the briefing and by virtue of your position, you could alter the nature of the amendment that you're relying on. I think there's a good argument you could do that. But my concern here is, even in your appellate brief, you have not staked out a position as to what amendment you're relying on. You didn't ask the district court, they've caught me. You're right. I'm relying on the Fourth Amendment. Let me amend. You didn't do that either. And so to the extent that there's this waffling, it appears, in which you aren't coming down in one camp. And therefore, why shouldn't the district court say, look, you didn't ask me for an amendment. You haven't told me definitively that you're relying on the Fourth Amendment as opposed to the 14th, and your brief below didn't definitively stake out a position on that, nor have you done that on appeal. So why shouldn't the court say, fine, if you aren't going to stake out a position, well, I'm going to go with what you've said, 14th Amendment, end of story.
I disagree with the characterization of our filings in the district court, and the filings here is we argued in the district court that there was no practical difference between the application of the standards. We also argued
you have said there's no practical difference, and you've said that above, but you can say I'm relying on the Fourth Amendment, but by the way, Your Honor, there really is no practical difference. But you haven't done that. And even right here, you say that Kingsley is probably the better test than the other one. And if Kingsley's the better test, why shouldn't you lose? Because it's clear that you're, at least by virtue of Booker, he was an arrestee.
And you froze there for a second. I couldn't tell whether
the... I'm here.
Okay.
Please go ahead.
Fair enough.
I'm here listening attentively. Go ahead.
We actually did in the district court and now argue that at page 139 of the appellant's appendix, that the excessive force claims are governed by the Fourth Amendment objective reasonable standard. So that's what, and then we spent a good deal of time saying that's the standard that applies here.
But you haven't even done, you just said that you think Kingsley test should apply. Kingsley is not a Fourth Amendment test.
No, so,
I won't take the time to go back and look at your brief, but in your brief, yes, you talked about Graham, but did you ever disclaim, I am not relying on the 14th Amendment. I am relying on the Fourth Amendment. Did you ever say that? I didn't see that anywhere. I don't see that in your appellate brief.
No, and I don't think our position is that it doesn't matter whether we cited to the Fourth Amendment or the 14th Amendment, because for the purposes of evaluating the facts, that and the substance of our complaint is that it both standards are the same. It doesn't matter which one we cite to. And as the appellees stated in their brief and response, prior to McGowan, it was not clear whether the objective test that applies under Graham would also apply to a pretrial detainee. I think in light of the Kingsley decision, I think actually the estate of Booker is probably the demarcation that this court reached is probably not correct, is because the way that the Supreme Court evaluated the pretrial detainees circumstances in that case under Graham, it's clear that when someone is a pretrial detainee depends on where they find themselves rather than judicial termination of probable cause.
Well, I mean, we're situated right here to reevaluate the state of Booker, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Situated here to revisit what Booker's rule is as to when you are a pretrial detainee and when you're an arrestee, are we?
I don't think you need to. As this court has done essentially since McGowan, from McGowan forward, is decide that it doesn't matter whether somebody, for the purposes of evaluating the facts, whether someone is an arrestee or pretrial detainee in the sort of circumstances we have here. I mean, clearly, when someone is arrested on the street, the Fourth Amendment applies. And for a Fourth Amendment claim, you actually have to have a seizure. And in this case, when somebody's being held by a county jail, as they were in this case, pretrial, there is no seizure and you can't actually make a Fourth Amendment claim. Now, I understand that Booker decided that there was a demarcation there, but I think McGowan has decided that under Kingsley, that it doesn't matter once they're in sort of the pretrial detention factual situation.
Well, why do you get the benefit of Kingsley anyway? I mean, you didn't cite it below. This issue was front and center in the briefing below, that there was a concern about whether it was the 14th Amendment or the Fourth Amendment. If your view was that the Kingsley test should have applied here and therefore they were coterminous, and you would argue that there, you know, essentially it was a distinction without a difference, why should you even get the benefit of Kingsley?
Well, we did argue that it is a distinction without a difference. That we argued,
yeah, but you didn't cite
Kingsley.
That the district court would have the benefit of that, which at least on appeal, you hit that drum quite often in saying that establishes it's a distinction without a difference. Well, you didn't give the district court an opportunity to consider that too.
Well, I think we did repeatedly argue that to the district court, that the difference did not matter and that the objective reasonable test under the Fourth Amendment is what applies.
But at the but absent Kingsley, how would the court have known that? I mean, how would the court have been able to evaluate that and know that?
Well, we did argue. I mean, we didn't have at that point the case was decided. There was no argument, I think, to a great extent, because the court had stopped doing oral arguments early last year. And so when McGowan came out, it was after the case had been fully briefed. And so this court's interpretation of Kingsley is applying essentially the same test in the situation of someone being held by a jail wasn't there for the benefit of the court. And so I think I think if we did have the benefit of argument, I suspect one of us would have looked and found McGowan, but that didn't happen. That there was no oral argument in the case.
So as you sit here today, I take it, is it your view that whether we apply a Fourth Amendment rubric or whether we apply a 14th Amendment rubric is irrelevant?
Yes.
Okay. And let's assume that the court erred in its threshold view determination as it relates to dismissing, because essentially you invoked the wrong amendment. The court never reached the qualified immunity issues in this case. If we were to find that you should prevail, would it be appropriate for us to remand for the district court to address those qualified immunity issues in the first instance?
It is probably more appropriate than having this court, just simply based on this record, do that. That would give the appellees the opportunity again, and as well as our opportunity to brief the issue before the district court. We did brief it and it was presented, but I think I would err on the side of your suggestion that perhaps it's better to have the district court address the issue first.
Okay. And I just want to put the fine point on this point. When I juxtapose the elements of Graham and the elements of Kingsley, yes, they're similar, but they aren't the same. To the extent that they are different, you're saying those differences are irrelevant. Do I get that? Am I correct?
Not quite. I think that all that the Kingsley did was take Graham, the objective reasonableness test, and transpose it into the situation where somebody's being held in a jail. So it's not a different test. It is both of them enunciated non-exclusive factors that a court's called upon to consider. The court in Kingsley and in Graham said you can look at these factors, look at other factors if you want to. It's simply the same test applied. It's just the factors that someone found themselves, the jailer found himself in that situation was presented with and had to consider, or the court has to consider after the fact.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Hopkins, please proceed.
All right. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Andrew Hopkins, and Frank Myler is also here with me today. And we represent the Weber County defendants. The dismissal of the district court should be affirmed. This is because either one, plaintiff's complaint fails to state a Fourth Amendment claim because it alleges he is a pretrial detainee, so the Fourth Amendment would not protect him, or two, because the undisputed material facts show that his probable cause determination had not occurred at the time of the takedown, and therefore the 14th Amendment violation that he pled would not protect him either. However, before we get into any of that, plaintiff's framing of this appeal allows for an easy affirmation by this court. In the issues presented in his brief, he asked this court to consider whether his rights were violated under Section 1983. This is easy to answer as no, because Section 1983 does not provide any substantive rights. It's simply impossible to violate somebody's Section 1983 rights because they don't exist. Section 1983 is a mechanism to vindicate rights protected elsewhere. It's not a source of substantive rights.
All right, but so your point's well taken, Mr. Hopkins. But so he identifies in the complaint 1983, and he says it's a 14th Amendment claim. One of the questions that I have generally about the case is there not some sort of distinction between identification of the basis for the claim and the underlying test? For example, if you have a Sixth Amendment, Third Amendment, whatever amendment claim or a statute, well, there are a number of cases that might enunciate the test. And I wonder if that's not what is beneath this conundrum here. The 14th Amendment, I think everybody probably would agree, is the basis for the claim. The Bill of Rights, as we all know, are not do not apply of their own force to the states. They are incorporated. And so his claim is correctly identified as a 14th Amendment claim. Now, that is there's a separate issue of what the underlying test is. But isn't Mr. Stevens, didn't he actually invoke absolutely the correct amendment? Now, he may not have added to that and said, that, well, the test is under the Fourth Amendment, because of Graham versus Connor and the state of Booker, but he identified the statute 1983, and he identified the applicable amendment, right?
Yes, but the problem with that then is it creates the 14th Amendment as this kind of this catch-all. So it's still the 14th Amendment incorporating in the Fourth Amendment, and then whereas a 14th Amendment excessive force claim after your pretrial detainee is a different test altogether.
And so the problem, I would assume, generally speaking, would be that the defendant is not alerted to the applicable amendment. But here you specifically argued to the district judge that the test is from the Fourth Amendment, right?
Yes.
So you knew that it was a Fourth Amendment claim. Your criticism of Mr. Stevens is, I suppose, to the district judge is, you knew that the right amendment applies. You're telling the judge that the right amendment applies. The judge knows the right amendment, but your problem, your argument is, so you should dismiss it with prejudice because he didn't tell the court what everybody knows, which you're representing to the court.
Yes, and the plaintiff had the opportunity to ask for leave to amend his complaint, and instead he stubbornly continued to insist that the 14th Amendment was the correct amendment.
How do you distinguish Macbeth versus Hines? Because,
excuse me, sorry.
I think I talked over somebody. I didn't mean to do that.
Go ahead.
No, you go, Joel.
No, you go ahead, and then I'll go.
Okay. Sorry. How do you distinguish Macbeth versus Hines? The panel is very specific that it's a First Amendment claim. The complaint does not identify the First Amendment. The response to the summary judgment on page 716 is relying on the Sixth Amendment, and Judge Abell, writing on behalf of the unanimous panel in a published Tenth Circuit opinion, says that the First Amendment applies. Nobody's prejudiced. The Tenth Circuit, am going to decide in reviewing a summary judgment ruling. Yeah, the First Amendment applies. Nobody, the plaintiff consistently, even to the court, was invoking the wrong amendment, and yet the court applied the correct amendment. It said you can't sustain a summary judgment because the plaintiff has, gotten a factual mistake about which amendment applies.
Right. And so in that situation, I would say then plaintiff didn't plead sufficient facts to show a Fourth Amendment violation because he alleges that he's in pretrial detainment. Now, the undisputed material facts showed that he was not a pretrial detainee yet, but his complaint doesn't then allege a Fourth Amendment complaint properly because he says he's a pretrial detainee.
Okay, thank you. And apologies to Judge Cross.
That's all right. And I guess my question was, I'm still trying to nail down exactly what happened. I mean, building off of what Judge Bacharach was talking about earlier, I mean, you say, Judge, this is Fourth Amendment, not 14th Amendment. You should pour out Mr. Stevens' client. I mean, did Mr. Stevens ever say he never clarified, did he? He never came back and said, yeah, that's what I mean. It's Fourth Amendment. I mean, he never came back in, as I read things, and made it clear, given the opportunity, what he was arguing. And then he actually even argued for a standard applicable to somebody who was a pretrial detainee and not an arrestee. I mean, am I reading that right?
Yes, and the district court even makes note of that he could have asked for leave of court to amend his complaint, but the entire time he continued to insist that the 14th Amendment was the applicable.
So I'm just wondering, in along the line of what Judge Bacharach was asking you, I mean, I'm all for forgiveness and for giving someone some leniency. But when they're asked to clarify something, I mean, are you aware of a case where someone's, asked by both party, by the party, the other party, by the court to clarify something and nail down what their claim is and they don't do it, that we then continue to play this game as the case goes up?
No, I'm not, Your Honor.
Okay.
What about pages 26 and 27 that Mr. Stevens was quoting from when he specifically says, quote, excessive force claims are governed by the Fourth Amendment's objective reasonableness standards. He goes on to identify the test and say that he satisfies it. He does it in footnote 2. He does it on page 26 through 28. And he does it, let's see, at one other place. And I believe it's in footnote 6, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, he makes all of these arguments that they're coextensive and that the 14th Amendment is the applicable amendment. But I think he clearly on pages 26 through 28 says, yeah, the Fourth Amendment applies and we satisfy that test.
Yes. And so all I would say to that is he's just asking then the court to read in to his complaint something that it doesn't say. It only says the 14th Amendment. He never specifically asked for leave of court to go and amend it because he wouldn't concede that the 14th Amendment might not be applicable.
Did that happen in Macbeth versus Himes?
I am not aware.
In fact, in the response, it seemed to me, I pulled it up, they did establish that it was a Sixth Amendment. I mean, they took that position in their response to summary judgment.
Well, we could debate it at conference, Jones, but what I'm reading is where the panel specifically is referring to the First Amendment claim. And you're right, they rely on the Sixth Amendment, but we can discuss this later.
Okay, so plaintiff spends a lot of time trying to argue that the Fourth and 14th Amendment standards are the same after Kingsley, but regardless of what the standards are or whether they were the same, the undisputed material facts that he had not received a probable cause determination demonstrates he wasn't entitled to any relief under the 14th Amendment standing alone, and any similarity to the test between the 4th and 14th Amendments is irrelevant to determining the actual constitutional provision that provides him protection. And then I just wanted to touch on for a few minutes alternative bases to affirm the district court's decision. And so as it relates to the individuals, they are both entitled to qualified immunity. And so for qualified immunity, it's plaintiff's burden to show that one, there's a constitutional violation, and two, that the violation was clearly established at the time of the events. So even assuming a Fourth Amendment violation was pled, the undisputed material facts show that the force used was objectively reasonable, even under Graham.
Do we really have a basis to make an alternative finding here on those matters? I mean, your briefing, unlike some of the cases where there was a shift in the nature of the claims that were made at summary judgment, for example, your briefing took the position, look, they've invoked the wrong amendment, and I'm not going to make a Fourth Amendment argument. You know, and so if this is different than a situation where you said you've invoked the wrong amendment and I'm going to tell you why you lose under the right amendment. And so really, do we have arguments sufficient in this record for us to evaluate this? And why would in the first instance, and why wouldn't we allow the district court to reach these issues in the first instance?
So respectfully, Your Honor, we actually did brief it as if he pled a Fourth Amendment violation, and showed why qualified immunity was still appropriate for them. And then it would be appropriate for this court to rule on it because it's been fully briefed.
Okay, and where specifically are you talking about in your brief? Did you make an argument under the Fourth Amendment? It was my position, my understanding, you did not do that.
One moment, please.
All right, I'm not going to take your time.
Right here on page 27 of our brief, we cite to the Fourth Amendment.
All right, go ahead, please.
Okay, so, I think it's important to remember then with the Fourth Amendment analysis.
That's page 27 of your appellate brief.
Yes.
Well, the point I'm making is that argument was not raised below. The district court did not deal with those issues. And ordinarily, isn't it appropriate to have the district court resolve those issues in the first instance before we reach them? That's what I'm talking about.
Yes, and we did brief these issues in the district court as well. And I don't have that in front of me, so I apologize.
Okay, go ahead, please.
Okay, so with the Graham factors, if you're going to apply a Fourth Amendment analysis, you also have to filter that through Turner versus Safley and Bell versus Wolfish. And Kingsley talks about this. That is, courts need to defer to the policies and practices of a jail that have been designed to keep the facility safe and secure. It's plaintiff's burden to show that defendant's actions didn't have a legitimate penological interest. He hasn't done this. The complaint doesn't say anything about the policy about removing boots. It just says that they use excessive force when he removed the boots. The jail has an important interest in maintaining the safety and security of the facility. Removing boots during the booking process serves this function. Otherwise, arrestees could smuggle in all sorts of contraband, like weapons or drugs, that could hurt themselves or somebody else that they're housed with. There's an urgency for boots to be removed when asked, even when some force needs to be used to ensure compliance. Plaintiff was uncooperative, it's undisputed, with his request to remove his boots. And the court has a video, and the video speaks for itself. The event's nothing particularly extraordinary. It's the sort of thing that happens in a jail all the time. And he was a drunk arrestee that was refusing to cooperate. And so, you know, it's just kind of necessary that some force is needed to use to ensure compliance.
Even when he's shackled and on the ground, do they still need to put a knee in his back?
Just to keep him down, yes. And they only did that in as long as it took to take the boots off, and then they got off of him as soon as the boots were removed. And the force used doesn't have to be the least restrictive means possible. It just can't be excessive. So defendant's actions were objectively reasonable, as shown by the video. And then as far as the clearly established prong, plaintiff hasn't identified a single Fourth Amendment or 14th Amendment case. Well, I should say, let me stick with just the Fourth Amendment, where excessive force was found with a similar fact pattern. And case law is clear that there has to be required specificity. It can't be at a large level of generality. And without a Fourth Amendment case that's filtering the Fourth Amendment through like the Turner versus Safley factors, it can't be said that the law is clearly established as to that defendant's actions violated the Fourth Amendment and were excessive. And then similarly for the county, there's alternative bases to dismiss the county as well. So plaintiff must show there's a constitutionally defective policy, that it was implemented with at least deliberate indifference, and that it directly caused the alleged injury. Plaintiff doesn't talk about policy at all. At best, he argues that the sheriff ratified the conduct at his deposition nearly 2 years later when he was being asked to view the video. And he said, yes, everything looks appropriate in this video. He was retired. He was no longer working for the county. He can't find the county anymore. And the case that we cited in our brief, Cordova, says that it's clear that events that happen after an incident don't suffice to ratify conduct and thereby bind a municipality. After all, how else could something that happens later directly cause an injury? So with that, does the court have any questions? Okay, thank you. This court should affirm the decision of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. I don't believe Mr. Stevens had any more time.
I did not, Your Honor. I didn't. Okay. If you have any more questions, I'd be happy to add to it. If you don't, I can submit it.
No, we'll submit the case on. Thank you, counsel, for the good arguments. I appreciate it very much.